Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Welcome back, listeners. So today I am joined by Dina Griffin, all the way from Boulder. Dina, are you in Boulder?
Boulder, Colorado.
Boulder, Colorado. I like going to Boulder. It's a lovely place. Is it snowing there at the moment, or is it 80 degrees?
Oh gosh, we did get some snow last week, and you know it's quite variable, but it is a chilly day today.
But it can change, can't it? You can wake up to 6 inches of snow, and then it can be 70 degrees at lunchtime.
I know, it's a beautiful part. And I'm up in the mountains outside of Boulder, so it's like a 10 to 15 degree Fahrenheit difference in that elevation change. So it's always exciting. Like, what's the weather here? And then, you know, 20-minute drive, what's the weather down there?
Keeps
us on our toes.
Okay, well, Dina is a sports dietitian, and we can talk about that in relation to my previous podcast a few weeks ago with Adam Fate from Precision Nutrition, where we discussed, is there any really difference between normal nutrition and sports nutrition? And Dina refers to herself as the nutrition mechanic. So I'm intrigued, Dina, about that title of the nutrition mechanic. How did that come about?
Yeah, I love nutrition mechanic. So I have an affinity for mechanics that fix, you know, like the bike mechanic, the auto mechanic, the electronics mechanic. And I personally, even as a young child, I loved fixing things, you know, when something broke, like the mechanical aspects. So I like the idea of, from a health perspective, and using nutrition to not necessarily fix, but fine tune and optimize and kind of tweak and adjust this dial over here and see what impact it has. So I like that kind of concept. But to be honest, Simon, the other reason I like the name nutrition mechanic is there's a microbrewery near Boulder called Liquid Mechanics. Mm-hmm. And I just love that name. So I kind of borrowed, don't tell, but I kind of borrowed their name and then my love for tinkering and fixing things.
In the coaching industry, I don't know if you've heard this, but we have this phrase or an acronym, CASE. Coaches always steal everything. There's not really anything new. Everything's, you know, re-engineered and reworked from what somebody else has done, hasn't it? Things come around that have been around before. And we, you and I and all the other coaches are just really custodians of this information. You know, we've inherited it from other people and then we're going to pass it on to others. And, you know, and as we'll probably talk about, there's no secrets really. To any of this, there's no secrets to good nutrition. There's no secrets to good sports nutrition. There's just some basic principles that perhaps we all gloss over in our rush to try and find the secrets.
That's right. Repackaging. Although I think we get elements of some new bits along the way, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, or just some ways to think of some things in health, nutrition, performance, and all of that can redirect us or, you know, take us down a different path.
It's difficult for the layperson, I suppose, because certainly in the UK, I'm sure it's the same in the US, barely a week goes by without a headline saying, oh, red wine, a glass of red wine a day is good for your health. You know, you'll live longer. And then a week later it says, red wine will give you cancer if you drink it. It's like, no, I don't know what to do. I should drink white wine. Or, oh, if you drink beer, there's too much yeast in it. It'll lead to this. Oh, no, beer's good, actually. If you get some of those microbrewery beers that have got less of the chemical ingredients and more natural herbs, maybe they've got polyphenols. So maybe that sort of specialized brewing is good for you in small amounts. So it's confusing, isn't it? And I guess that's one of the important features of the work you do, is to try and help people cut through all of that rubbish and understand what the truth is.
Yeah, it's like a translator, you know, because we have the research in the real life? And then what? How do we cross over and take the bits and pieces of what we know from research? And is it good research, or, you know, how, who's it apply to? Yeah. And then translate that to the individual. And of course, as you talk about tons of times in your podcast, just the context matters, right? And the application of that research. So it's really working with that individual and learning about their challenges and goals and so on. And then, you know, filtering the science to figure out what elements do we apply, or where do we want to go?
Well, the reason I've got you onto the show today, Dina, specifically, because I mean, there's loads we could talk about, but you were doing a Training Peaks coaching call the other week, and you were speaking very definitely about nutrition for female athletes. And it's been one of my missions, really. I'm not sure how successful I've been. I'll have to count up, but to have more female guests onto the show and to talk about more female specific subjects, because I just think they get ignored often. And I know Stacey Sims is keen on saying women are not just small men, and, you know, you can't just pink it and shrink it and give females the same food as men in smaller amounts. So hopefully our male coaches and those male coaches or our male listeners will definitely be partners of females or brothers of females or sons of females. And so, you know, this isn't just about the coaches. It's about all of our male listeners understanding about female nutrition. And particularly if you live in the same household and you go shopping together, why you might need to think about different things. It's also for some of our female athletes to try and unlock some of the puzzles they have, because a lot of the information they read will be based around research on males. And so, you know, it's not necessarily applicable to them. So I sent you a lot of questions. Did you find them a little overwhelming when they all came through?
I mean, if we have a couple days, we can get through it. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, Simon. And I guess just a quick moment to applaud you for, you know, being willing to chat more in the realm of female-specific needs or the female athlete context, because it isn't, you know, up until a few years ago, it wasn't talked about or maybe even recognized that this is something that warrants extra attention. So thank you for whatever we're going to talk about today. I appreciate it.
Well, on your first point about us talking for 2 days, some of my listeners and my friends have been nodding, saying, "Well, that'll be Simon. He could talk until you fall asleep." on that second point, I have female clients and female athletes, and I'm always just, you know, in a selfish way, trying to find ways of me helping them better. So even if we didn't have any listeners, I'd still find this a useful conversation.
Me too.
So let's start off right at the beginning. Taking the female athlete, is it common for female athletes to overlook that they have different nutrition requirements to males? And we talked about the typical example where you've got a couple of people, maybe they're both doing triathlon, so they'll go shopping together and they'll get food that they both like. Yeah. And it'll maybe be what they like rather than perhaps what they need nutritionally. But, and I guess a lot of guys will say, yeah, I need more protein and I need this, but how, is it common for women to overlook what they really need nutritionally and the fact that that might be different?
You know, I think part of this, that word overlook, maybe we change it to, it's just not knowing. And sorry for just that subtle difference there in the wording, but I think a lot of this is education and becoming aware that as females, and the information we've been told either from a coaching perspective or nutrition and health perspective, in the female athlete context, that a lot of that info was just generalized from, like you pointed out, it's research that was done on men and it was generalized to women, assuming that we are not that different. And so as women, you know, I don't know that it was overlooking the fact that we have different needs other than maybe we are smaller in physique or size and so we should technically eat less or something. But that awareness piece in education, I think we just didn't know because we didn't have much science to show us that we have some differences.
And do you think it's more likely to be an education thing then rather than convenience or peer pressure or marketing? I would think that that's probably a big thing for most people, is the marketing and the, you know, the power of the food industry. Do they all have components in this as well, or is education the main driver, do you think, and understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think education is one of the biggies, but then just realizing, you know, the sport science, sport nutrition science, the fact that it, quote unquote, right, again, I'll use the air quotes, but just easier to do on male subjects. And so that convenience factor with regard to study design, you know, and maybe not wanting to put the effort in to study women, or like, that's too complex with hormones and periods and all this stuff. Like, how do we apply that to the male species? So I think part of it was convenience in the science realm. And then as it has evolved in the last 30, 40 years, seeing through the science that there are differences. And then that's that education piece to the food industry or the coaches or the other practitioners.
Mm. I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it, about development of scientific studies and how those are based around men. You know, I've been participating in some heart research studies, and they're looking for recruits for another one now. And I put a little post out on social media, and I had several messages from females saying, I'd love to take part in this. And I'm sorry, it's a male only one. Well, why? And of course, what you just mentioned there about monthly cycle, the menopause, hormones, these are the exact reasons, or some of the exact reasons why females do have different nutritional requirements to men.
Yes. And, you know, that part isn't really all that new. It's just, I know that we want to talk a bit today about the female athlete, but we, you know, for a long time have known women are different with respect to cardiovascular health and the biological changes that we go through in our lifespan. But it's now in the realm of sports science, we're really appreciating so much more that there are these nuances. And it's nothing impossible to figure out. It's just that we have so much more to learn, but we've got bits and, you know, so much more emerging research to work with so that we can apply that to the female athlete, which affects health too.
And of course, health for me is more important in some ways than sports performance, because we talked about those foundational elements. In order to perform at your best as an athlete, whatever sport you're in, you have to have good health. And so we should always be focusing on what's good for our health first, and then layering on our athletic training and everything else as the next level up the pyramid, really, but with the foundation of, you know, how do we improve what we eat? How do we improve our blood sugar management? How do we improve our hormonal control, our, you know, our sleep, our mental acuity, all of those things first.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like age differences, male, female, then we've got medical health history, you know, any kind of disease risk. And so all of those layers together definitely warrant the attention to that health foundation. And then the performance, athletic performance side is one of those little niches or angles that certainly, if we have that foundation very robust, absolutely that will make the performance potential so much more easy to achieve, or at least take some of the barriers down.
Is that the difference then between a sports dietitian and a dietitian? Is that you will have the end goal of improving sports performance, but still That's the top point, isn't it? I think beforehand we said we can't call it the icing on the cake because that would be inappropriate. So we're going to call it the olive oil on the salad or the sea salt on the broccoli or something.
Exactly.
But it's the finishing touch. But there's no point in somebody coming to you saying, right, Dina, I need help getting the perfect nutrition plan for my ultramarathon or my Ironman, when the other 364 days of the year they're going to McDonald's or KFC. You know, you would start at the beginning, wouldn't you, with let's see how we can make your diet more nutrient dense instead of calorie dense.
That's how I see it, right? Because we, for our training as athletes, you know, that might be 1 to 2 to 4 hours a day or something like that, right? But and then we've got sleep, which is 7 to 8 hours. But then we have all that other time where we're working, we're nourishing the body, we have stress and all those other things to deal with. So like the daily nutrition, that's a large proponent or a large proportion of what can make or break health. And so we have to look at all of those pieces first. At least that's what I believe, and really try to get away from just being okay or adequate or not sick and being closer to, you know, better and more optimal. And then that training and sport nutrition side with ergogenic aids, or, you know, maybe there's some other supplements, and the training, nutrition, recovery, that all comes in. But without that foundation, you know, then we're kind of working harder for not as much benefit.
Reminds me, I was a fitness coach for a rugby league team. So that rugby league's like NFL without the pads, right?
Yeah.
professional sport. But these guys were more like semi-professional. So they had jobs, but they turned out and they got a small amount of money to play at the weekends. But, you know, it was a competitive league. And the coach had big ideas. And so he said to me, right, Si, you know, we need to get them fitter. But what we're going to do before a game, we're going to take them to the hotel and we're going to stay in the hotel overnight. And we need to spend a bit of time thinking about pre-match meal, you know, definitely a pre-match meal to get them in the best shape. I said, Steve, we can think about a pre-match meal if you like. You know, it's more likely to be a placebo, because these guys, as soon as they finish the game, they'll be down the pub and they'll be getting a takeaway at night and they'll be having a fry up for their breakfast in the morning. You know, the pre-match nutrition is not going to help when the rest of their nutrition is poor.
That's so right. Yeah. And I think that's part of it, right, Simon, is just showing athletes, you know, all the other hours in the day can have this huge impact on your performance. So it's worth your time to look at it. And even if it's, you know, minor changes that you're willing to make as far as behavioral aspects or habits and things like this, I mean, that's worth it. But it's trying to find the readiness of that individual to make those changes can sometimes be a kicker.
That's something that they taught us in the precision nutrition coaching is ready, willing, and able. You know, are you ready to make the change? Are you willing to make the change? And are you able to make the change right now? Because you might be the first two, but maybe because you've lost your job because of COVID, or you're on furlough, or you haven't got as much money coming in, you're not able to do anything about it now. So you've got to have all three of those things in place. And what, you know, when I'm working with people, that we look at, well, if you're not able to do this now, what are you able to do? So it's always about moving the slider from not so good to a little bit better. Even if you make small changes, as long as you keep making small changes over time, when you look back, you're going to be in a much better place.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's be a bit more specific then. So we talked about females are different. I think it's probably once females have gone through puberty, I think it's probably based on your previous presentation, it's fairly easy to divide those females into three main categories, I think. So would you like to make a start with that and explain what
okay,
they are?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, and then we can go as deep as we want, or I'll let you direct, but so yes, after puberty, we could say the general three categories of a woman's life cycle would be, you know, those reproductive years, or what we could also say is premenopause, and then a next phase that occurs sometime usually after age 40 would be the perimenopause years, where the body's going, undergoing a number of changes, getting ready then to make that next biological change, which is postmenopause. And in between peri and post, we have what we say is menopause. And it gets a little confusing using all these words, like how old are we or what's going on in the body? But menopause specifically is really only one point in time, which is 12 months after the last menstrual cycle or the last period has been experienced. So it's like this single point in time, and then we're in postmenopause. So it's really only peri and post, but a lot of times in the media we say, oh, you know, I'm menopausal, and I don't know if that really means you're in perimenopause or you're done with all that and you're in post. So that's just a, you know, kind of a clarification point.
Interesting that you confirm that, because I had a guest on the other day, a GP who specializes in helping females through the menopause and exercising around that. And she made I'd made that mistake of saying, so we've got premenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. She said, no, there's really only two. There's either pre or post. And then there's this sort of gray area transition when you're sort of switching from one to the other in the middle. So we don't really talk about that. It's either peri or post. So
yeah,
good. So, one other thing I was, because I had a lot of questions, and most of the questions now relate to each of those particular phases. So one of the things I was thinking was maybe we can create a fictitious character and take her through from, let's say she, you know, exits puberty around 16, 17, and she's then got the next 24 years in that reproductive premenopausal phase. So maybe we should talk about our fictitious character. So we should probably give her a name. What should we call her?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Let's call her Liz.
Liz. Okay.
I don't know why I picked that name.
Somebody will be there going, it's me. Yes. We don't have the Queen listening to this, so it's not her.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So we've got Liz. So we're going to take Liz through the Liz is an active female. She likes sport. Let's say that she's she's involved in swimming and running at high school, which is often how a lot of triathletes start out. You know, they do cross country and they swim for the school team. And then we'll follow her through. She remains active. You know, we'll give her a normal life. We'll create this we'll create this little life for her. So Liz is now in the reproductive pre-menopause phase. So what are some of the commonalities that as coaches, or you know, as the male half of a couple, what are some of the commonalities around that stage of life that we need to be aware of, and particularly with respect to nutrition?
Yes, and Simon, put your coach hat on too, so you can talk to anything that you want to bring up in terms of how we might coach. There we go. There it is.
Coaching.
I didn't mean literally, but that's perfect. So yeah, in the reproductive years, pre-menopause years, you know, we can break this down even further. So if we just think about hormonal fluctuations and sex hormones, that being primarily estrogen and progesterone, we've got a woman who can be naturally cycling. So that really just means not on an oral contraceptive is what we can say for the purposes of this conversation. So if Liz is not in this scenario, not on an oral contraceptive, you know, she's letting her body make its own natural hormones. And so what we hope for is that there is this regular cycle, meaning a regular menstrual cycle is, you know, 26 days to maybe 38 days in duration. So it's not really a 28-day for every single woman, but there is this 26-ish to 38-ish kind of time frame for a menstrual cycle to occur, assuming no pregnancy happens in our Liz scenario for right now. So we've got in the menstrual cycle, we've got this lower hormone phase, which typically, again, I'm just using generalizations, Simon, but day one of a menstrual cycle is the first day of bleeding. Again, assuming no pregnancy has occurred. And that lower hormone phase usually lasts about 14 to 15 days. It's going to vary. So each woman will be different, but I know we're just kind of looking for some commonalities. In this lower hormone phase, it really means that, you know, time of bleeding or menses, estrogen and progesterone are at their lowest relative to the rest of the menstrual cycle. And so a lot of people will say, oh, in, you know, when you're having your period, you're most like a man in terms of the hormonal balance or the hormone levels, that being estrogen and progesterone. And then as we start to get closer to that midpoint in the menstrual cycle, closer to ovulation, we see a rise in estrogen levels. And we can talk a little bit about what these hormones do to the various systems in the body, if you like. But I'm just kind of walking through the cycle. And then we can apply it to what does it really mean for us as women. And so you have this rise in estrogen. We have some other hormones that are, you know, getting ready to help the egg be released from the ovaries. So we've got a number of things going on in the body. But after this ovulation occurs, we enter this higher hormone phase, which means progesterone is coming up in our bodies. And that, again, is really just preparing for, you know, the fertilization of the egg, if that's going to happen, right? So we're waiting, like, is this egg or, you know, the follicles, what egg is lucky enough to get fertilized? So progesterone comes up. This is that other hormone, predominant sex hormone. And then we also see another rise in estrogen, although it's not quite as high as right before ovulation. But relative to the day 1 through day 15, progesterone and estrogen are higher until that egg is fertilized or not, right? And usually in this scenario, I'm talking about no pregnancy. We're just talking about a menstrual cycle. So without fertilization of the egg, then the hormones will drop. And that's the basic shedding of the uterine lining, where then we repeat this cycle once again. So there's a lot going on, even, you know, minute to minute, there's a lot going on with these hormones. But if we just say day to day throughout, we can call it a 30-day cycle, there's a lot of flux compared to what a comparable, you know, male athlete or similar age and body type and all that. There's a big difference there in just these hormone levels that affects brain and kidneys and bone and muscle, on and on. A number of tissues in the body are affected by this hormonal flux. So I'll pause there because I know that was just a big dump of thoughts on you.
Okay, so I've got my coach's hat on now.
Yep.
And so I'm thinking, okay, so the females that I've observed in my lifetime, and, you know, I'm not the sort of bloke who just ignores all of those things and goes, ah, that's just women, are that they all respond differently to this. Some seem to be affected more emotionally by the monthly cycle, and others seem to breeze through it. I know some females that I've coached have bigger challenges with training and what training they can do, and others just seem to bounce straight on through it and it doesn't affect them. Is that a reasonable observation?
Well, I would say yes, because of what I was alluding to in terms of the variation in the hormone levels. But the fact is that between women, we have differences, right? So you could take the same you know, 30-year-old, I don't know if you use meters or whatever,
we're multilingual in there.
Okay. Same height, same age, same body weight, same lean mass, on and on, same training program. It's very possible that they respond quite differently to the training stimulus as a result of those variations in hormone levels.
Okay. So I guess those females that are engaged in the training would probably be aware of whether they, you know, feel better or worse at certain times in the month. So in term, let's talk about nutrition, because that's the main reason why we're talking. We talked about low carb, high fat earlier, and I've seen some commentary where they suggest that females who might be, let's say there's a couple living together and the male partner says, yeah, I want to go on this low carb, high fat. I've heard Simon Ward talking about it and apparently it's brilliant, so we should try it. So this is what we're going to do with our shopping. And so his partner goes along with it. And apparently this is absolutely the wrong thing to do, because at certain times of the month, when you said females are probably in the low hormone phase, when female hormones are more masculine, they may respond to a low carb, high fat diet better than they would do in the high hormone phase when the estrogen and progesterone are higher. Is that the right interpretation?
We can say that. I mean, I think we also have to be careful of the generalization. So we'll just say that once, and maybe I'll say it 400 more times. But I would say in that lower hormone phase, if we're going to do a lower carb sort of dietary approach, that would be more acceptable. But we also have to consider so many elements of that female athlete's existence, right? So is she eating enough, period, right? So there's just overall energy intake, you know, the other sleeping well enough and some of these other things. And then again, what is low carb, high fat? So there are different interpretations of that. So, you know, we just have to peel apart those layers to really determine, you know, is this helping or hurting, or, you know, too much confusion for then the rest of the cycle. So yeah, a lot of it depends.
Oh, well, that's good, because we people are always pointing the finger at us coaches for saying we use the phrase "it depends" a lot, but it does, doesn't it? You know, it's like you said, you could have two people who look identical, and I guess there's studies showing that even if you've got twins, they might have different hormonal patterns. So,
for sure.
You know, it's impossible to tell unless you have people who are engaged. And I guess the first thing will be to track actually what does happen, and then start doing those little experiments yourself to find out, well, what works and what doesn't. One of the questions I always have for people now, having tried this myself, when they say, I want to go low carb, high fat, or I want to go keto, is what's the driver behind this? What are you expecting to do with low carb, high fat? I mean, if somebody said, well, actually what I want to do is just maybe reduce my carb intake a little bit, but I want to be a bit more precise about the carbs I eat, so I'm eating less processed carbs and less from refined sugars and more from tuberous vegetables and real food that I've grown in my garden. Well, hurrah for you. That's a great exactly. approach to take, but that doesn't necessarily equal a low carb diet.
Right. So I think you bring up a really good point, Simon, which is if an athlete comes to you or me or whomever, like, I want to do keto or I want to do low carb, high fat, like, well, what is your expectation? What is it you're hoping to gain from that dietary pattern? And is it appropriate? So really, I think taking the time to understand that carefully and then explain the nuances behind it. But you're right that for a lot of people, the assumption is carbs are just breads and rice and pasta, you know, and we forget, or it just isn't known, that there are carbohydrates in vegetables and root vegetables and fruits and right, and nuts and seeds, we have carbohydrates. So maybe they just meant they want to clean up or improve the quality of the carb sources. And yes, high five to that. But then we can be more specific with the timing of those carbohydrates to support the body's needs and support the training. So again, that goes down another conversation path.
I do think that people find out just how many foods contain carbs when they go down the keto path, don't they? Because all of a sudden they've got this list of foods that they can eat, and it's like, what? Where's my, you mean I can't eat these? All of a sudden keto is not quite as attractive, is it, when you see the restrictive list of foods you can really eat and how little carbohydrates you can consume?
Oh, I know. And I've run into athletes who even just a green bell pepper versus a red bell pepper, you know, there's like 1 gram difference in carbohydrate. They will be that specific to pick the 1 gram less. so, you know, I don't know, and I don't usually support that level of you know, carb counting to that degree, especially for female athletes. But, you know, for someone who has diabetes or metabolic conditions that we're working on from a medical perspective, maybe, you know, that very low carb, high fat, I mean, we have research to show some efficacy there. But again, just putting in the scope and the context of the female athlete, we want to be mindful of the appropriate dietary strategy.
So we're not saying, because again, if we read the popular press, athletic press, it might have suggested that females definitely shouldn't be following low carb, high fat or keto, or maybe even fasting, which we can come into a moment. We're not saying that they should never do that, but what we're saying is that they perhaps need to do a bit more research, educate themselves a bit more, understand what they're trying to get out of it first before they do go down that path. And I suppose if you're just trying to go low carb, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to feel a little low on energy for a few days, as long as you don't follow that path for several months and end up in a relative energy deficiency situation. We don't want that, but try and get over one or two monthly cycles probably wouldn't be that much of a problem, would it?
You know, I mean, I think we just have to be careful. Yeah, if we're doing keto or low carb, when is it being implemented and why, right? If it's for body composition changes, you know, there are many other strategies that can work. I know some people prefer to, they just feel better eating lower carb, right? Or lower carb, higher fat. But there's just a lot of misconceptions about that approach. And I think there are a number of risks that we're now seeing with female athletes in particular. And that being what you just mentioned, like, relative energy deficiency in sport. So one thing that I've seen, Simon, that if you don't mind me sharing, is when, and this applies to some male athletes too, but when undertaking, let's say, keto or very low carb, appetite is satisfied, right? Like, we are very full from eating a lot of fat. And so we, at the end of the day or the end of, you know, the course of a week with a high volume of training, we start to see that energy availability to the body becoming lower. And that has negative implications or negative impact on so many systems of the body. So that's the worry, is that we're going to get into that mode of really just not taking in enough calories to support, you know, what the body needs for all of those basic metabolic functions. And that over time, even though you may feel good, it's over time where some of those negative health aspects start shining or coming into the picture. So it's kind of like, oh, you know, if we're going to do keto, let's be really particular about why and make sure this is truly the only strategy that makes sense, because a lot of times it's not the best for a female athlete.
Yeah, it seems to me a lot of the time when, regardless of whether it's male or female, that an athlete latches onto a particular form of philosophy of nutrition, it's because of something they've read or because of something they've seen other people do, and they decide that they want to do that. I fully take your point that a lot of people end up on keto and are following it long term are doing so because they're coming from a medical position and that is actually a better way for them to eat. But they're not coming from a healthy position where it's just like, oh, I'm going to try keto because it's good for losing weight. And yes, it is. But is it sustainable? Because we don't, you know, it's very, very difficult to follow a true nutrition program where there are rules, if you like, and certain things you should be doing and certain things you can't be doing. To sustain that for months and months and months and years is really difficult. If it means you've got to go to 15 different stores to buy your food, if it means that none of your friends will go out to dinner with you because you become the fussiest eater ever and they'd rather leave you off the invite list, if it takes you 2 hours to prepare your food because blah, 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 it's, you know, it's great for a while, but then 12 months later...
Exactly.
Perhaps not so. Yeah.
Right. And the other thing to think about when we come back to our made-up athlete, Liz, is that eventually, you know, she's going to reach those perimenopausal years. So what we're seeing, Simon, is that, and you had a guest not long ago talking about gut health. Bella, was that her name?
Bella, yes. Bella Linderman, yeah.
And so there are a few things here is that gut health controls so much of our body and our body's systems. What we're not sure of yet is, but you know, there's some signs of this, is that a very low carb dietary pattern implies low intake of those plant foods. I understand there are people who insist that we can do vegan keto. So I understand there will be some pushback on what I'm about to say, but the worry is that long-term, or one of the worries, is that long-term keto is also affecting the gut microbiome. Mm. And as women, when we start getting into perimenopausal years where hormone fluctuations become more frequent, we might have estrogen dominance. There's a whole host of things happening with the body that if gut health isn't strong, robust, diverse, you know, the microbiome isn't diverse, that will exacerbate a number of the biological changes that occur that we don't desire, meaning you know, I'm sure you're aware of like the hot flushes, migraines, mood issues, brain, some nutty things going on with the brain. Like I can't focus.
Brain fog.
So that gut flora really will impact how we proceed through our biological life. And so that's another aspect independent of performance concerns that I just wanted to make sure I mentioned.
No, that's an interesting point here as well. And I think it's, if I think back to my own time between the age of 16 and 40, I wasn't really concerned about how I was going to be when I was an older person. I'm much more concerned about now what I'll be like in 20 years' time than I was back then because it seems so far away.
And, exactly.
You know, I have this analogy of the physical pension, which is what we're doing here, what we're doing with our nutrition, what we're doing with our sleep and our strength training and everything else to put good health aside so we can draw on it when we're older, when we get our pension and actually all of these amazing things that we've got on our bucket list that we're hoping to do when we've packed in working. If we're not careful, we're not going to be in a fit physical state to achieve all these. We're not really mindful of all of this because, you know, between 16 and 40, we're indestructible, aren't we? Everybody knows that.
Oh yeah.
So there's a point about when you're younger, if you have got some emotional intelligence to look at these things through a sort of like a different lens, is what am I doing? And maybe it is more important for females based on those hormonal changes that you've mentioned in sort of perimenopause to be thinking about that and what are they doing? What are they doing now to set themselves up for a healthier and easier menopause, postmenopausal
Period. Yeah.
So let's see if we can get some clarity on this then, because we've bounced around a little bit here. In terms of how our female, how Liz should be trying to shape her nutrition. Well, let's take a fairly even-handed thing. She's not gonna be an extremist. She doesn't want to be a keto vegan. She doesn't want to go and live in a cave and be a paleo athlete. Maybe she does like the idea of growing her own food, which is always a good idea. So what are the key things we'd advise, and are there any definite don'ts that you would say stay away from?
Okay, yeah. And she's still in her pre-menopausal years, right? So, I mean, I think here, and this is something I see with a lot of female athletes, is not neglecting protein. I think a lot of women think, oh, I eat enough protein, or I'm not supposed to eat, you know, that much protein. And it's all relative, of course. But I would say the protein piece is very important, not only just from the daily nutrition aspect of, you know, consistent protein amounts throughout your main meals, but it's also not neglecting, sorry to use a double negative, but not neglecting the protein in that post-training, post-workout window. There is a difference between men and women in terms of that, you know, resynthesis or that repair timing that needs to be in place. So with Liz, you know, we want to make sure, depending on the training session, that she does get in a good 25 to 30 grams of a quality protein source within that, you know, 30, 45 minutes of completing the training session. Of course, there are a lot of depends around that. Like if it was just a, you know, spin out, short spin out on the bike, maybe we don't have to hit some recovery protein versus, you know, a very high intensity session, breaking down a lot of tissue and things. So protein is one element, and certainly that becomes more on the radar, Simon, with the higher hormone phase, just due to the catabolic nature of progesterone. So it's not like you have to eat dramatically different in your protein from low hormone to high hormone. It's just that we want to make sure we're not forgetting that protein piece post-workout and in the higher hormone phase. And this will support recovery. It supports just management of that hormone flux that occurs. I think if I can keep going a minute here, I think when it comes to the carbohydrate sources, I mean, even though, yeah, when we're 20, 25, we feel resilient. If we can start building some habits there to fuel our bodies with quality sources of carbohydrate, more from whole food sources than relying a lot on engineered foods. I mean, that just does us better from that inflammation aspect, from, you know, getting all the micronutrients that come with those whole food sources of carbohydrate. And it's setting us up for what's to come down the road, even though it's hard to think about 10 years from now, 20 years from now. But the other thing I wanted to say with carbohydrate specificity is in that higher hormone phase, so just that latter part of the cycle, is that our bodies don't do as good of a job at storing carbohydrate or the loading carbohydrate. It's not quite as effective, especially compared to male athletes. So timing of carbohydrate around very key training sessions is important in that higher hormone phase. And that's just going to help reduce some fatigue. It helps with any of those quality sessions. Just being particular about timing of carbohydrate, right? So we're not dieting around training sessions. We're fueling the session appropriately.
It seems to me here, I've mentioned this before, and people are probably a bit tired of me mentioning this now, but mindfulness around what you eat, planning ahead with your food, making, you know, even at the beginning of the week, planning where your training is and then what food you're going to need to support that training. I mean, I would advocate this for males and females, that you should be giving some thought to, not just, yeah, well, we'll have this here and we'll have that there, but why are we having this here if we need that protein? Also, one of the big things that I've observed with males and females is that that they don't get enough protein, but also that they don't spread that protein intake out throughout the day. So most people don't get much, if any, protein. The only protein they might be getting in the morning is something in their milk, if they've got. And if you're getting skimmed or semi-skimmed milk, you might not be getting very much in there. They might not have very much at lunchtime, and it'll be an afterthought. So it might be something in a sandwich rather than part of that sort of food portion thing there. And then the back end of the day will be loaded with protein. So they'll have a big piece of chicken, or they'll have a big piece of fish or something. So working out how you can get more protein in at the beginning of the day and spread that intake out. And again, planning what you're going to do, because you will hear a lot of people say, well, I need a carbohydrate drink, or I need something for after my training session. But they don't plan to have a meal there. So they're nearly always looking for protein shakes because it's something quick and easy. But there's nothing wrong with real food as that protein source after a training session. It's just that it requires a little bit of manual labor to make to get yourself a tuna salad or a chicken salad, doesn't it, or a little chicken sandwich.
Exactly. The planning is key. I know it's one thing for me to be saying, oh yeah, just do this, you know, even protein distribution and don't forget. But yeah, I mean, that is absolutely one of the key essentials here is, I mean, of course, educating ourselves what we need, but then planning for that and having it ready to go. That will certainly help our success. So I think, you know, I was just thinking, Simon, of a couple other things. Do you find hydration is often neglected?
Again, it's an afterthought. That. So you hydrate when you think, almost like drinking to thirst. And there's been a lot of misinformation come out, hasn't there? You know, the book Waterlogged didn't do us any favors because it threw into confusion all the stuff we've ever known.
Yeah, exactly.
The marketing from companies like Gatorade and Powerade also sort of muddies the waters a little bit. And so it's always difficult to know what the true story is. But I still, again, just plan to drink a certain amount of fluid throughout the day. Make sure you get some electrolytes in there and you'll probably be okay.
Yeah. And I mean, when we talk about female athletes, it is more in that higher hormone phase, especially for women who are in hot climates, humid climates. There's a change in fluid balance. There's a change in sweating thresholds. You know, there's just a number of things going on, again, with respect to how estrogen, progesterone are behaving and how they affect kidneys and cardiovascular strain and so forth. So it's really not like hydration in and of itself is not something to be neglected. And I think this is an education piece. I can't tell you the number of times where I've just had some women pay attention to day-to-day hydration, but also hydration and smart hydration around their sweaty workouts and the rehydration. And it's made such a huge difference in recovery. You know, that fatigue level is improved. I mean, it's just not something we think of because we're always thinking of fuel and carbs and, you know, that aspect. But the hydration piece certainly makes a difference in performance and then that recovery element.
I mean, I don't advocate people weighing themselves very often. You know, I think people get overly hung up on weight, which I have, you know, a lot of that figure is just transient anyway, isn't it? It's depending on what time of the day you weigh yourself. Yeah. But one thing I have noticed is I have a set of scales that measure my hydration. And whilst I don't think they're particularly accurate because it's just a signal that's going up through my feet, there is some correlation I've noticed between heart rate variability and whether I'm in a better state of readiness and my supposed level of hydration. So I noticed that I'll weigh less. But I'll weigh less because I'm a bit more dehydrated. And on those days when I'm my hydration's not as good, my heart rate variability will be worse as well. So that's one of the things I do encourage people to do, is perhaps to weigh themselves, but not be so concerned about the weight, but the sort of micro makeup of, you know, fluid and body fat. And also another thing to remember is, if you are following a low carb diet, you will lose weight to start with, because that's just the body getting rid of the excess water. It doesn't need to support the carbohydrate molecules.
Exactly.
And what I've noticed also is, if I'm on a lower carbohydrate time, you know, a period of training when I'm eating less, then my hydration status appears to be worse, but it's not. It's just that my body's not storing as much water. So there's a lot of nuances here, I would think before people start trying to do the tiny little things, it's look at the important things, like, am I drinking enough? Am I eating the right amount of protein at the right time of day? Am I timing my nutrition around my training? And for females particularly, am I timing my nutrition and being more mindful of maybe altering it a little bit around my time of the month? And what it seems that you're saying is that higher hormone phase is perhaps when Liz needs to be more mindful of what she's eating. She needs to be more focused on eating a protein. She needs to be more focused on quality hydration and more focused on the carbohydrates, particularly in that second phase of her monthly cycle.
Yeah, hydration, protein, right? Because body's a little bit more catabolic, and there might be more fatigue, and inflammation in terms of systemic inflammation might be peaked a bit. Immune system might come down as well. There's a lot going on with that stage. And so I suppose as a coach, then you can also think about, because I think we're in the midst of this paradigm shift on how we train female athletes. And I know we're talking more nutrition here, but I'll just throw this in and we can leave it, thinking of training the female athlete differently in low hormone phase versus high hormone phase to work better with her physiology. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women are resistant to that. Like, I don't want to change what my training buddies are doing, you know, or I don't understand how that's going to benefit me. And then there's also education from the coach's aspect too. Like, well, she can do so much more, you know, intensity wise during this phase versus the higher hormone phase might be more appropriate for, you know, your more aerobic workouts and things of that nature. All of those pieces can come in.
No, that's interesting. And I do think that, again, a lot of what athletes do in training is driven by what their friends are doing and what other people are doing, or facilities or sessions that are put on. So it's like, well, I must go to these sessions here because they're on those days, rather than, well, actually, that doesn't fit into my, that's actually not best for me. You know, I'm a lark rather than an owl. I'm an owl rather than a lark, but I'm still getting up at 5 a.m. to go and do swim sessions when it's perhaps not the most appropriate thing for you. And the education around, well, do you know what, if you try this for a little bit, let's try a polarized training program when you do your high intensity training, but rather than spreading them out two a week, what we'll do is we'll do four per week in these 2 weeks here, and then we won't do any for 2 weeks because you're not really going to respond. Or maybe we'll put some very short little bursts in, but not enough to fatigue you, just to remind you in the neuromuscular phase about pushing out a bit of power or a bit of speed, but we'll only do one or two as a reminder, and mostly it'll be longer duration stuff. I'm guessing that you wouldn't, even in that high hormone phase though, even if you're doing the lower intensity stuff, you wouldn't want to push the volume too much because that would still challenge recovery, would it?
Yeah, and I think, good point, it is seeing the how resilient that athlete body is, and sleep, and the things you talk about almost on every podcast, you know, all the other bits and pieces that can make or break that time frame. Mm. I think it depends, Simon, right?
I think I'm going to have a book called It Depends. I'm sure there must be one out there already. So, and once again, we come back to what we talked about right at the very beginning about just be willing to try it for yourself. You know, you might be one of those females that actually has a very short bleed cycle. Your low hormone phase is shorter and or longer, and you have a very short high hormone phase or whatever. So your timings might be very difficult. You might have difficult monthly cycles, or you might have very easy monthly cycles that don't cause you any discomfort. And you may not be affected by changes in training, or you may be affected. But I think what it seems like is that the athlete and the coach have to work together and be open with each other. And they have to be open to change and experiment and try and just see what works. One thing I would say is just don't try everything together. Don't try changing nutrition and training in the same one, because you'll never work out exactly what was the thing that worked and what wasn't. So you have to be patient and say, right, well, for a couple of cycles, we'll work on nutrition and see what happens there. Maybe we won't need to do anything with training. Right, then let's go and try into training now. And then eventually, after a few experiments, you'll hit on the pattern that works for you. And that's when you have to try and change all your friends doing your training rather than doing what they're doing. Otherwise, you'll end up back where you were.
Spread the love. Yeah. I think what you are saying just reminds me of one other big point, which is, yeah, tracking for yourself what it is you're feeling. I mean, if Liz, you know, is naturally cycling, right, then she can just start noting whether that's old school, you know, on paper, you know, here's day one, here's how I feel. You know, if you're using Training Peaks, right, you might be then have your heart rate and power info, and you can log your metrics, fatigue, sleep, soreness, and do that for 2-3 months. And if you've got a coach, you know, then that's excellent to have someone. I mean, ideally, you've got a coach and a dietitian, right, or a coach who is knowledgeable of the nutrition elements, so that you can really have that set of eyes on the patterns and then make the adjustments that will just take that athlete to the next level.
Is there an app? Is it called Fit Our Female or something, or Fit Our Training? That I've heard that you can use it to plug into Training Peaks, and you can plug in your monthly cycle there, and it will give you some guidance on training.
Yep, Fitter Woman is FITR is decent for noting trends and logging signs and symptoms.
Okay, all right. So we'll put a link to that as well.
And there's another cool one, Simon. Okay. I think it's still in beta testing that I've been playing around. Wild AI, which is artificial intelligence kind of app. That's really, it's a dynamic app, and it's pretty cool. It's going to be really helpful.
Okay, there's a few little artificial intelligence apps coming out at the moment. I know Alan Cousins, a guest of mine recently, who you might know from Boulder. He's actually got his own one, isn't he, that he's involved with? I can't remember what it's called now, but...
Human Go.
Yes, that's right, yes. Just in terms of training, I've heard a lot about that female athletes should definitely consider lifting heavier weights when they get into the perimenopause and postmenopause phase. Is there anything, aside from the cardiovascular aerobic style training they do, that they should be doing more of in this reproductive premenopause phase?
So, and I'm sorry, did you say in the premenopause?
Yeah, in so Liz phase? At the moment, okay. 16 to 40, yeah. is there anything specific she should be doing with strength or mobility here, or are we just giving the same general advice to prepare yourself for older age?
I mean, I think it's helpful to build that regimen earlier on, so that when you get to your 40s, you're not suddenly, you know, all brand new to lifting and doing these right. multi-directional movements and things. So, I mean, I'm a big fan, especially for what it does for bone density, mm-hmm. you know, and building lean mass, because, I mean, the more we do when we are more able, then it's just helping that transition be less of a, you know, cumbersome part, right? It's like I'm more resilient to take on, and I know that when I'm 80, I'm going to be able to carry my own groceries and things.
That's quite an interesting contradiction to what we've said before about women are not small men, is that actually I think that in what I've observed in a lot of females around that 16 to 40 age group is that they'll say, well, I'm not a man and so I don't need to lift strength, you know, I don't lift heavy and it's not feminine. And I think that's a big mistake. I think we definitely need to educate females and coaches that their female athletes should be lifting weights, and it will definitely have some very profound health benefits aside from the performance benefits.
For sure. Absolutely. And that goes to our Liz, who's, you know, reaching her perimenopause years, if you want to go there, Simon, because that piece, what we are now seeing much more through research in real life is that, and even if we took out the athlete part, I mean, we know that with the changes in estrogen and progesterone that occur, our bone density starts to decrease more quickly. It is easier to lose that lean mass if we don't have the right exercise stimulus and if we don't have the right kind of dietary pattern. So an emphasis, if it wasn't in place before, you know, for Liz now, let's say she's 42, you know, and menstrual cycles are starting to be more erratic. Maybe she's getting some other signs and symptoms. You know, it's easier. Like, I can't eat the way I did when I was 25. I gain weight more easily, or I bloat, or I have, you know, I'm starting to have all these changes from a biological perspective. That's a great time to put in that heavy lifting and, you know, that different stress on the skeleton, the muscles, right? I mean, just changing that up can make a big difference for how vasomotor symptoms are managed. How even like sweating during exercise, there's a whole host of things that can affect thermoregulation, heart, the cardiovascular system, that strength and power element. And then from an aesthetic kind of body composition perspective, you know, that lifting, and of course we've got the whole nutrition side over here with protein and changing up that for perimenopause, but all these things together will help that gal, Liz, just manage this change in her life so much more easily.
Okay, so as she's getting into the perimenopause, then we talked about and I do think that, and I think, I don't think men are exempt from this either, that as they get into that thing where they get this, what they think is middle age spread, you know, I've looked at this and thought, well, middle age spread is just your body has you've got a lower metabolism and you're probably a bit more sedentary than you used to be, and you're probably eating a bit more comfortable than you used to because you can afford it now. So there's just a calorific imbalance there, and there you go, and it's all going on around your middle. It's not rocket science. But so if I just burn more calories by doing more riding or more swimming, and everybody neglects the strength training, everyone. It's a big thing of mine, and you know, you mentioned that I make reference to sleep and nutrition and everything else in my podcast. Strength training for everybody's not far behind that either.
lifting
more and lifting heavier weights and not being, I think part of the problem is that females in particular, but endurance athlete males, are concerned that they will gain muscle and they will gain weight and that will negatively impact their performance. But you know, the effort and the food consumption required to gain substantial quantities of muscle is huge. Most people wouldn't have the time to train. And actually, when you're doing lots of cardiovascular training, that sort of counteracts that anyway, doesn't it? So, you know, I don't think you need to worry about gaining too much muscle, really.
No, unless you're following some powerlifting, you know, regimen. And you're right, you have to eat a lot of calories to build that much bulk. And mass. So for the endurance athlete especially, that's not usually a thing. And I think the other thing is just thinking of the beauty of building power and strength as we age, right? So it is to combat some of those age-related effects.
So what will Liz be doing then to adjust her eating as she goes into this perimenopause phase? I mean, I guess there's some subtle changes there. As her periods start to change, then are we getting shorter or longer low hormone or high hormone phases, or just more erratic?
It can be more erratic, Simon. So that's a thing is, you know, again, tracking to see what, you know, what you can learn with what's going on. Nutritionally, protein, again, I'm like the protein queen here, like protein. As we get into peri postmenopause, our protein needs actually increase a bit more. And this for men too, actually, just again, age related changes. So specific to Liz and her athlete self, the recovery, you know, post-workout protein that we're seeing that needs to go up towards, you know, 40 grams of protein. That's to combat some of the changes that we see with estrogen levels dropping because we don't have that same anabolic stimulus. So we need, again, proper exercise stress, the lifting and change in that endurance focus and protein. So overall daily protein may increase, but it's also a attention to that post-workout protein amount.
Just to be specific about protein then, you mentioned that pre-menopause it's 30 grams post-workout and perimenopause it's 40. We usually see figures bandied around how many grams of protein per kilogram of body weight or how many ounces per pound of body weight. If you give me the figures, I'll work out the European equivalent. So what would it be for our younger Liz in the pre-menopause? Per pound
like
of
daily
body,
protein.
Yeah, per pound of body weight, yeah. What would she be?
I know. I think in kilos too.
Oh, okay.
So I'll probably just stay with that since I don't have my calculator. But I mean, daily protein for premenopausal, you know, I usually give ranges, Simon. So like 1.5 to 1.8 grams per kilo. Sometimes upwards of 2 grams per kilo. And then as Liz and our perimenopause into postmenopause, it's more like 1.8 grams per kilogram body weight, upwards of maybe 2.4 grams.
Wow. Those are figures that are much higher than I'd normally see even for athletic females.
I know. Well, so we want to look at within that range, what kind of training load is on the body. So then we work and periodize the protein and the nutrition around the training.
Okay. So maybe in the high hormone phase, it would be on the upper end of that range you've given, and on the low hormone phase, it would be more towards the lower end. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. Or if you are in a lower hormone phase, you know, with a, pretty high volume block of training with some intensity in there, then maybe you're still on the upper end.
And I think we should be clear here because I know that there may be people thinking, well, you know, I've heard that too much protein's bad for the kidneys and it'll put them under pressure, but actually there's no real evidence to support that eating this volume of protein, or even I did read some work that was done through the NSCA where they had people on double the recommended doses of protein for over a year and they didn't see any negative impacts on kidney function. So I don't think you need to be worried about eating a little bit more protein and any negative health impacts.
Right. Yeah. I know work by Dr. Jose Antonio did some overfeeding studies.
Yes, those are the ones I'd read. Yeah.
So long as healthy kidneys, right, and there's nothing else going on, from a medical clinical standpoint, there's no, I shouldn't say no, but there hasn't been shown any risk to having that amount of protein.
Are there any other food considerations we need to have then for our perimenopausal Liz? Is there anything she needs to worry about with carbohydrates or if hydration again, you know, she's starting to get night sweats?
So carb-wise, again, I'm thinking of the gut because we're just, again, seeing more you know, findings that gut health matters. So, you know, to repeat what Bella said in her podcast, I'm a huge fan of, you know, diversity in our plant foods and carbohydrate sources. So even though I hear a lot of times athletes say, I can eat the same thing every day, I just want to eat, you know, be a robot and eat the same thing, that I would encourage to still swap out the kinds of plant foods and have that variety and work with seasonal availability of foods around you. So it is making sure, if that's not in place already, that we've optimized whole food sources of carbohydrate. We're not relying too much on, you know, energy gels to fuel our workouts, that we can use some of that, of course, is appropriate for racing and long training and race simulation for racing nutrition. But there's so much more in terms of fueling opportunities for training sessions to use, you know, a little less on the engineered food, and that can help the gut as well. And hydration, yeah, is another one.
I'm quite a big fan of Bijou Thomas and Alan Lim. Have you seen their books?
Oh, yeah.
Feed Your Own Portables, and they have some great ideas in there for real food and getting that into your ride nutrition. Not as easy for run nutrition, but certainly for ride nutrition, you know, making little rice cakes and rice balls, and you can make some fruity ones with dates and sultanas, or you can coconut flakes and that sort of stuff and honey, or you can make some savory ones, can't you, with egg and ham and
it's that beautiful
yeah.
Oh, I know. I think once we open our minds to eating that kind of stuff and making it, or having your training partner make it, it's like, it's tasty, and you don't get flavor fatigue and you don't get gut bombs and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's definitely important. And then the hydration, I mean, this is where, you know, making sure that we are well hydrated around our sweaty, hot, you know, training sessions, and that rehydration piece, especially for the women who eat very little processed food. I mean, they eat a lot of whole foods, which is amazing. A lot of times we need to add salt. You know, there's just not enough salt, especially if you are a heavy sweater or a salty sweater. We can actually benefit from adding salt to food, or using a good hydration formula, right, to hold on to the fluids better.
Do you have any homemade hydration formulas that you use, rather than just putting a noon tab in your water? She's one of my listeners, actually, Margaret Sills, but she sent me a little recipe where she has a little bit of agave honey in there, and she has a little bit of lime and lemon juice in some water, and a bit of Himalayan sea salt crumbled in there, and she leaves it to mix up, maybe gives it a bit of a whiz with the blender. That seems to provide her with the hydration that she needs. And I know she, if she's listening, she might supply us with that recipe again. She did before.
Yeah, similar blend. I mean, I like the tart more than the sweet, but yeah, lemon or lime juice with a sweetener. A lot of times maple syrup is used instead of honey, just due to the differences in the type of sugar source. Yeah. For those that have some fructose malabsorption, the maple syrup might be a touch better than honey. And then, yeah, the salt piece. So that's really the key. But the sugar is there to help with that transport of the fluid and uptake of the sodium. So it's like, yeah, salt, sugar, water. And then if you need some other flavor, you know, tart or other sweet, depending on your palate. Super cheap and easy to customize and just blend it up. And I was using a little bit of tart cherry with a little bit of lemon juice, just for that, you know, kind of tangy tart on the
I'm just conscious of the time now, Dina.
Oh, so yes.
Just,
Thank you.
Let's let's think about how do we, we've talked about more strength training for bone density and metabolism. Any other training considerations for perimenopausal, Liz?
I mean, one of the other ones is just thinking, especially for triathletes, is working different movements in terms of that multi-directional movement and not just running or forward movement. So it's just trying to put different stress on the skeleton.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like your plyometrics and you know, different kinds of lunges and that. Mm-hmm. And I think we've covered most of the keys for the nutrition element. You know, a lot of good foods for the gut, hydration, protein, quality carb sources, you know, and then if we've got that going into post-menopause years, it's almost like you keep that going. You know, it's like perimenopause is our time. It's like our, it's kind of like a training phase. It's like a life training phase that we can use different interventions from the exercise and nutrition element to set us up for maintaining strength in our 50 and older range and not compromising health either.
Okay. So that's good then. So really post-menopause in terms of the way we approach looking after our body, both physically and nutritionally, is really just an extension of perimenopause then. So we've laid the groundwork. We've laid the groundwork. Young Liz has been very diligent. She's listened to our podcast. In 50 years time, she'll be saying, I remember listening to this podcast with these two, Dina and Simon, and they talked about this and I listened. Now look at me. So she's laid the groundwork. Yeah.
Yep. Simon, the other thing to just keep in mind is this change partly due to age, but also with hormonal changes is an increase in insulin resistance, right? So this does speak to balancing blood sugar with how we put together our meals and really bumping up fiber foods, making sure we don't neglect protein, just because that can be exacerbated with age. And so if, again, laying groundwork, if we eat to stabilize blood sugar, it's going to help with mitigating some of the body fat gain and some of that other predisposition to diabetes and things like that as we age.
Is that purely a female thing?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, it does seem to be increase with women who get into their, you know, 60s and 70s, but that could also be because, like you said, we become more sedentary or just other changes in life. But I would say men, you know, if you pay attention to that earlier, it will help you later on.
Mm. We haven't talked really about supplements. I get a feel that you, where possible, will prefer people to get the minerals and vitamins they need from whole foods and from that diversity we've talked about. But are there any particular supplements that Liz, in each of her stages of aging, her chronological stages, might want to consider?
So part of that would depend on her dietary preferences, you know, if she wants to be more vegetarian or if she's omnivore. So we have that consideration. And again, that would apply to men and women. But specific to females, I would say omega-3 is oftentimes a supplement that is recommended, and that can help with inflammation that's more on a systemic nature. It can help with brain health, some of the recovery aspects. And it's, you know, just helping, again, as we age, that cardiovascular health. Mm. So omega-3 supplement, sometimes magnesium is helpful. Again, this isn't maybe specific to only women, but in a higher hormone phase, that magnesium supplement at bedtime can help with more restful sleep and helping some of the inflammation that occurs in that higher hormone phase. So those are the two biggies, but adaptogens, Simon, that's a whole other I don't know if you've had any guests on about adaptogens, but you know, it's herbal, like botanical class of plants that have been around for a long, long time that can have some benefit as we get into perimenopausal years, you know, and we have a change in some of our signs and symptoms. The adaptogens like ashwagandha is one of the more popular ones that can help with...
You're going to have to spell that for me.
Yes, I can shoot it over to you.
Okay.
Adaptogens can be another one that's helpful.
Okay, well, we'll have... I'll tell you what we'll do then. If you... Do you have something on your on a resource like that on your website or anywhere that we can point people at?
I don't... I might have a blog. I'm not sure, but I'll just send you... I'm making a note. I'll send you what some considerations would be.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, omega-3, actually, that's an interesting one. A story I've told once or twice before. With the proliferation of corn-fed animals, particularly beef, I know it's probably more prevalent in the US than it is in the UK, but there's a lot of omega-6s in there with the high fructose corn syrup, and there's an imbalance of omega-3s and omega-6s now, isn't there, in the wrong way, so more omega-6s mm-hmm. less omega-3s. I was once at a restaurant with some friends in San Luis Obispo. We went to this place called the Madonna Hotel. It was a beautiful hotel. And the waiter was there, and he was saying, "We've got this lovely steak tonight, sir." And I said, "Oh, excuse me, is it grass-fed or corn-fed?" He said, "I wouldn't know, sir." He said, "I'll go and ask the chef." All my friends are like, "What? What do you mean, is it grass-fed or corn-fed? You'll be asking if we've got grass-fed salmon next or corn-fed salmon, grass-fed." I still, to this day, I don't live it down, but there is more incidences now of people talking about, yes, it's grass-fed beef, and they make a big thing. But... yeah, I was aware of that several years ago about the balance of omega-3s and omega-6s and trying to be mindful of the source of my meat and my food to make sure it's got more omega-3s in if possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do that with so many elements, not just the protein sources, but the plant sources too, right?
Yeah. So. Fish oils at all? Are you a fan of those, DHA and that sort of stuff for mm-hmm. sort of cellular protection and some of those?
Yep. Yeah.
And we can get, you can get fish oils or fish oil substitute, can't you? From things like krill for, I don't know, actually no, there's some plant-based omega-3s, aren't they, that are supplements that aren't fish-based for our vegan.
Like the seaweed or the algal oil
would be...
For those who don't, you know, want to do any fish or marine derived products, then we can go for the, you know, seaweed and all those. It sounds funny, but it's actually a really good source.
Mm. Yeah. Great. Well, I feel much more educated about all of this now, Dina. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, there's so much more to it, but I know we've touched on a number of highlights that I think are really important. So I appreciate you chatting about all of this.
Well maybe what I say this to all my guests, because they always sort of step up and deliver such useful information, that I've no doubt that we'll have you back on the show. I've no doubt that this will generate some conversation. So maybe the next time we get you back, maybe we'll ask people to send in their specific questions and see if we can give some sort of more case study type answers for certain things.
That'd be great.
But I'm going to put some show notes together, Dina, that will go after the show. Where can people find out more about you, please?
Oh, thank you, Simon. Yeah, my website is nutritionmechanic.com. And I have a newsletter sign up there. If you want to get little tidbits of info from me, you're welcome to sign up. And, you know, I am on Instagram. Nutrition Mechanic is my handle. That would probably be one of the better places. Facebook is Mechanic Dina, because someone else had Nutrition Mechanic.
No.
I know. But the website's the best.
Mechanic Dina. Okay, well, I'll put those. I'll go and find out those links and put the correct ones on. So we're going to send them to nutritionmechanic.com. So great. Thank you for being on the show. I guess if anybody's got any urgent questions, I'll probably get them to write to me, and then I'll send them to you in a sort of condensed format together, rather than having you bombarded with questions from across the pond.
Cool, Simon. Well, I appreciate you and all you do for the athlete community and all of us. So thank you.
Well, it's a team. You know what they say, it's a team approach. Do you know, I couldn't do this on my own. I definitely wouldn't have been able to deliver this quality of information just chatting directly at the screen. So I appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much. And yeah, listeners, thanks again for being here and staying the course. I hope that you've learned at least one thing today. If you've learned more than that, then it's been an hour and a half well spent in our company. And so we both thank you for that. And we'll be back next week with another fantastic guest. But for now, bye from me and bye from Dina.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.